This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. In the riveting book, The Alchemist, written by Paulo Coelho and published in 1988, the central character, a boy named Santiago, has a dream about a buried treasure and goes off on what becomes a profound journey to find it. During this psychologically embedded search, he meets an alchemist, a wise man who encourages the boy to think in terms of turning basic elements into gold. For the alchemist, this transition relates to mind, body, and spirit. This is a book about following one's dream to find their purpose in life. The story is one which always challenges me to think beyond the obvious of what we see each day. In the world of theater, film, dance, and opera, we have alchemists who spend their lives crafting the simple into the sublime, the innocent into something sinister, or capturing historical renderings on the canvas of a face. I am speaking about the alchemy of the makeup artist. The craft is a paradox. There is a whiff of mystery built through skill and discipline of the art form. And my guest today would tell you it's actually all about storytelling. Well, the craftswoman I speak of is Academy Award-winning makeup artist Lois Burwell. She is responsible for the work and creations in makeup for films such as Braveheart, Almost Famous, The Last Samurai, War Horse, Saving Private Ryan, The Princess Bride, Legend, and the incredible Spielberg telling of Lincoln. This is just a short list of her work, ladies and gentlemen. She has had the distinguished role of working with Steven Spielberg on at least 6 films. She has served on the judges panel of Sci-Fi's original series, Face Off. And in 2017, she was voted the first vice president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And personally, she has the honor of being the wife of legendary cinematographer John Toll. For them both, the film industry has been an alchemical journey, and I hope they will never stop looking to create gold. Well, Lois Burwell, welcome to Center Stage. It is such an honor to have you as my guest.
Oh my goodness, that was such a fantastic introduction. I forgot that we were going to be talking. Who's that interesting person that I'm about to meet?
Well, I was getting to you, my dear. There is no question about it. And I remember when I first met you just recently at the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival, the minute I sat down by you and realized who you were, I realized just how special you were by your own look, which is so distinctive. And it's interesting, you do makeup, but yet you wear very little.
Well, the thing is, I find other people's faces much more interesting than my own. That's the bottom line. And, you know, it's sort of boring to look at the same face every day. I quite like seeing other people's faces and seeing what I can do with those. So that's why, really. But I suppose what I then do is I'm very fond of clothes. So probably if I was a costume designer, I'd just wear jeans and a t-shirt.
Yeah, I get it. I totally get it. Well, do you think I'm right in my introduction? Are you an alchemist?
I don't know. I'd love to be. I think that that's a wonderful description. I can definitely see some of my colleagues being alchemists. And I know that my husband, John Toll, is most definitely. Hard to see about yourself. I mean, I think that commenting or thinking what you possibly are is rather like seeing your eyebrows. They're the closest thing to your eyes, but you need a mirror to be able to see them. You know, so I'm not really certain. But yes, I mean, the art of makeup is definitely alchemy. Yes.
There is no doubt about that. That you actually bring up a good point about looking at yourself, you know, and you're being very humble right now, I feel, because definitely you do spin creations and out of very simple beginnings. And I think your art form is so fascinating because of it.
Yes, it is. When you're in the zone of creating, seeing a face and then seeing the possibility of where that face can go or what can be brought out from it or added to it, It's a very strange thing. I mean, I personally can't do that thing that I admire in other people, which is that they can talk through it and do small talk or whatever it is. And if I do a demonstration makeup, I forget to speak. I can't say, and now here what we're doing is, while I'm doing it, I just go quiet and it sort of happens. And I don't mean that in a pretentious way, but it somehow just happens. But it's not necessarily a plan, you just know. And I think the closest to way to describe it is when it really connects and happens is in that probably Eskimo art form, which is that what you're doing is you're just removing in order for the sculpture or the shape to already exist. It already exists and you discover it. It's that kind of feeling.
Very interesting. That's definitely in the zone. I love that. You know, I really want to talk to you about your background a bit. We know you are English, and I think you were born in Hampstead in North London.
I was, oh, well done. Yes, I was born in the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson Hospital in Hampstead Heath. Yeah, I don't think it exists anymore, actually.
Were your family involved in the movie business at all?
Oh, good God, no. My mother, both my parents were older when they had me. They were in their mid-40s, and I was their first and only child. Although they got married in 1938, so they'd been married a considerable amount of time. And my father was an electrical electrician, but he was an electrician, a household electrician. And my mother started off as a seamstress working. She left school when she was 12 and went to work for a dressmaker that made court dresses for, debs that were coming out. And then she retrained as a telephonist. And in fact, during the war, she had a very interesting job because she was working at Grosvenor House as a telephonist there, which is a rather posh hotel for those who don't know it,
Quite.
in London. And then when the Americans joined the war, she went to work as a telephonist in the basement of Selfridges, which was the American Army's HQ in London.
Very
So,
interesting.
yeah,
I
so that was
didn't know that
interesting.
about Selfridges. I actually didn't
Yeah.
know that. One of my favorite stores when I lived there, by the way, Lois.
Oh, there you are. And
Oh,
American owned. Selfridge was American.
totally, 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 totally.
And yeah, it's a great store, actually. The most wonderful lifts. They have got those Art Nouveau lifts, which are just splendid. I hope they still have them. But my father, he had a very difficult war, let me put it that way. So he was subject to sometimes great depression and was really frightened of any kind of lightning and thunder, any kind of thunderstorm. So I always felt, I mean, in a bizarre way, I don't know why I'm talking about the war, other than, it leads to Saving Private Ryan, which I think was for me a very special film. It was a very personal film because, Dad was landed on the British beach, sword on D-Day, and, went through France onto Belgium and then onto Holland to liberate Holland. But he was attached, funnily enough, another American attachment. He was attached to the American tanks as an engineer.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. So I think for Saving Private Ryan, that's the film that was closest to my family because I was sort of brought up with the idea of that the war happened, 2 minutes before I was born, rather than a significant, more than a decade, because it affected our lives so
So
much.
much.
Yeah. And Dad, was obviously still alive, and he didn't want to come and visit the set, which was very unusual of him. And he didn't want to come to Ireland. He didn't want to, see anything like that. But he did impart something, which I then relayed to Tom Hanks and the boys on that film, which was that when the landing craft
Yes.
hits the shore and the tailgate comes down, that's the frightening time because there's nothing stopping the bullets
Oh.
anymore. And all you do is you follow orders because you can't think, you can't do anything other than what you're told to do. So that was sort of interesting. And he did visit the set, but at the Rommel part when it was the flyby and the fighting was over.
Very interesting. So really, you were made to do that film through your father. I'm sure there was so much recall in the back of your mind, as you said, the war was 2 minutes before you were born. The scars of men in England, I know even when I first went there to live in 1977, you could still see it on the streets in some of the injured, in the men who were still alive, and the stories of the rationing. I mean, all of these things were so profound for every person in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, when I was growing up, in the 60s, that there were still bomb sites. No, it wasn't uncommon to see the bomb sites around London. So I think it was something that was very close. And it meant so much. The wonderful thing about that film was when it was screened, the veterans who saw the film actually resonated with it. And
Really?
yeah, and were so grateful that it was a depiction of what it was like on the D-Day landing, rather than, and I don't mean disparaging to anyone else's work, but rather than that kind of Audie Murphy version,
Absolutely, absolutely.
So,
No, I understand.
I think it was a really wonderful opportunity to work on that film, but it was really hard. It was incredibly hard.
So let's go with that right then, because I have so many questions actually about Saving Private Ryan. And really, with regard to the makeup, I mean, I already still have a frisson from what we're talking about from just PTSD, because it's really difficult for me to watch war films and Holocaust films. And I swear, I always tell my husband, I think in another life I was in the war, and I was one of those soldiers ready to get off, on the beach and filled with fear. When I watch these films, I'll never forget Tom Hanks's performance in this movie, right down to his hands shaking all the time, not being able to hold the cigarette. But what I think about with regards to the makeup is, how do you keep this refreshed? The filth, the hair, the mud, the wigs. How do you do it?
Well, the biggest challenge, actually, let's go back to the beginning on the drawing board, is that the whole point of uniform is to make people look uniform. So to distinguish one character or the principal actors from the surrounding soldiers is always tricky, especially when they're all in helmets, they're all in the same uniform. So what we did was everyone had their own kind of unique pattern of dirt. And where you could, obviously, with Mellish, she had a moustache, so that was an addition. But with some of the others, it would be, small details or keeping the shape of the dirt separate and different from each other. So you could identify them easily rather than wondering who the hell's that. There's always a problem in war films. But to maintain it, some of the things, when they were in the sea, it was tricky. So we had dry suits on and floats that we could put the makeup on in a plastic bag. So we had lots of plastic bags and lots of running in and out of the sea at Wexford in Ireland. And it was tough. I mean, filming on beaches is always tough. Walking on sand is always tough, let alone with all your equipment. You've got the peddlers with a gallon of blood in, you have boxes of prosthetics, you've got all those things, and people think of makeup being quite light. Actually, it's incredibly heavy most of the time. And you're
Absolutely.
wearing a load of bags. And there were 97 steps, which I'll never forget, from where the makeup trailer was on the cliff top down to the beach. And then a quarter of a mile walk to the set with all your equipment. So that was challenging. And Stephen was filming at a really fast pace. So you had to be on your mettle. I mean, at one point we had 11 cameras on the beach. So I had a makeup artist with every camera because what that camera was going to be shooting, so they had to dash out and either do touch up or add blood or injuries or anything that was demanded in the action for that shot. So it was challenging. But all of that I seem to recall, and it is a recollection. I don't know if it's an absolute fact. I might be a day or two off. But basically, from the whole landing, that whole Normandy landing, up until them achieving the cliff top, we did that in 3 weeks.
Wow.
So it was going some. I mean, it really was.
Incredible. How many did you have in your crew?
There were five of us in on main team, and then we had additionals that would come to help.
Wow.
But we had a, you know, the crowd, there was a thousand crowd background, thousand crowd soldiers, Irish Army, and we had 28 principals, and I think it was somewhere in the region of either 48 or 50 stunts.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's go back a little bit. When you are first offered a project, do you like to sit with the story and do you storyboard yourself? And do you have immediate hits in your mind about the direction you want to go, or do you just start working with the director immediately?
No, well, it depends on who the director is and what the story is. So that shifts and changes slightly. But basically, for my method is that I read the script and then I reread it, having read it once so that I know what the story is. Then I reread it and start to think about the details within the script of the characters. Then I read it again and start my makeup version of my own makeup script. So, for example, you have a character and they say time passes. Well, how much time? Is it enough time to grow a beard? Is it enough time for a, for hair to grow? I mean, what does that look like? Is this the middle of the night? Are they tired? Have they gone to bed? Have they got a cold? Is it cold out? Is it hot? Are they sweating? Are they worried? What's the time difference? Have they aged? How are they feeling? Are they well? You know, all those questions you ask yourself, and then set within the storyline of if it's period, then, you know, is this a hygienically clean period or are they a chimney sweep? It's all those layers. So you get the patina and you work with the patina on the script. And then I go and have a conversation with the director, but I might pull some images from either research. It could be a painting, it can be something on the internet, it can be personal photographs, it can be any of those things. For example, when we did War Horse, I asked everyone, because you know the Great War, the 1418 War, was something that affected most families in the UK. So I would ask everyone on the team to get their either grandfather or great grandfather. If there were any family photographs of that time. And it does two things. It engages people with the story rather than it just being turn up for work. You know, it also engages you because you have the opportunity of recreating, which is exactly what happened to the wig maker who was making the moustaches, Sarah Wedderburn. She actually got to recreate her grandfather's moustache on one of the actors. That's how she modeled that particular moustache. So, and that was tremendous. And there was one actor, Pip, who looked exactly like his grandfather, so much so that his grandfather had died during the Great War, and his mother was pregnant with Pip's father. So he'd never met him. He'd only ever seen
Oh
photographs
my
of his
gosh.
grandfather. And then Pip was playing a colonel, and we made the grandfather's moustache so his dad, who was in his 90s, when he actually saw Pip, his son, look like his father, the father he'd never met. It was very moving. And that's a wonderful opportunity to do something like that.
How
Yeah.
deeply personal. And I believe that also in Warhorse, you were dealing with a whole equine arena. You were
Yes, there was
taking
a
care of
makeup.
horses.
Yeah, there was an equine makeup department, which I don't know if it was a first, but it was definitely a first for me. And because we had 16 joeys and six top thorns, and of course, horses like people don't look like each other. You know, they are individuals. And obviously, Joey was meant to have a white blaze and four white socks. And you're dealing with horses that are trained to a level where they have maybe one skill. And a horse can only work for 2 hours maximum before they have to rest, which is fair enough. So you had multiple horses that had to come in because the working day is the working day. And making one horse look like another is quite tricky. But you use the same as you would with a person, the eye to mouth ratio. And what we did was we shaved out the blaze and had little wiglets made in different dimensions to either widen or lengthen, elongate the face, or bring the eyes closer together as a cheek, because you're never seeing them in comparison to each other. You're only seeing them one at a time. So
Exactly.
that really, that's what we did. And all the top thorns had to be black. So if you had a horse, for example, who was a bay, but really had great talent at lying down, which there was, who was this wonderful horse called George, who was so relaxed. And in the, I don't want to spoil it for anyone if you haven't seen the film, but there's a reason why the horse has to lie down for a significant amount of time. And George was just perfect at that. And then you've got wonderful moments. I remember Sueno, who was one of the Joeys, was there as George was lying down and actually got concerned because George was so relaxed. And he wasn't drugged or anything. I mean, he was just a bomb-proof horse who liked to lie down. So, Sueno came over and was putting his muzzle on top of George's. And of course, it's in the film because it was just wonderful. And
Oh.
all of us, we were all crying because it was so beautiful to see. I mean, I will spoil the story actually because it's a dying scene. So you're upset anyway because Top Thorn's dying.
Right,
And then you get this horse who's standing there suddenly coming over and showing concern. And we were awash. We,
Oh
all
my
of us.
gosh. Oh my gosh,
Yeah.
those moments. And they always seem to happen for Steven Spielberg in his films. It's
Yes.
like the
Well, it's
skies open up in the perfect sunset for that man.
exactly. I think it's what he brings. I mean, he brings a magic.
And speaking
Yeah.
to that, I watched the most fascinating interview with you and Janusz and Rick Carter and Michael Caine, where you were addressing making Warhorse when you just come off of Lincoln. And there was such a beauty, there was an aura between all of you that really spoke to the camaraderie that went into that film, and all on behalf of Steven Spielberg.
Yes, yeah, so that's what Stephen brings out from you, and it's also how he relates to you. He's absolutely 100%
Yeah,
committed
he
to the
is.
storytelling process. And what I really love, the moments I love the best, are when everything comes together and his enthusiasm knows no bounds. And it's as if he's 9 years old and it's yes. And it's absolutely full of every moment of joy and thrill as if it's his first day on his first film.
Film, yeah.
There's nothing jaded or, we're doing this again about him,
But at the
which
same
was
time,
wonderful.
he's the most magic storyteller of all, perhaps. But at the same time, he expects everyone to do their job, and he has an expectation of all of you to be there and prepared, doesn't he?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. He's a hard taskmaster. And you go to him with an idea, and you might think it's a real killer of an idea. How fantastic is this? And you think, oh, I'm going to get a brownie point. And no, what happens is you end up having this conversation, and rather like that game where you put one hand on top of another and it goes up and up and up, that's what he does. So he'll take an idea and go, yeah, but can you do this? Oh, leave it with
Interesting.
me. And you go off. So when you come back, at the end of the film, working with Stephen, you're a better makeup artist than you were on day one.
Right.
And I've never known that not be the case. And you're more ready to make that film on the last day than you ever were on the first day.
Quite. Exactly. I understand that. But that's the magic of Spielberg. I remember at the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival when he presented Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And he told a wonderful story about sitting with his father on a night sky watching a meteor shower. And that is when he fell in love with the stars in the sky. He brings that element to everything, whether it's the War of the Worlds, Indiana Jones, I mean, of course, E.T., Close Encounters. We all want that emotional journey with him. We want to go on that emotional journey. And that's what's so perfect about Amblin Entertainment, isn't it? I mean, it's him. It's just him.
Yes,
Wow, very
that's
interesting.
absolutely right. And I mean, he appreciates the work. He might not at the time, because it's all about what's going on in that shot, and it's the performance. So you have to be able to duck and dive.
Okay.
You have to. I mean, one time I remember, one of his favorite things is to say, "Hair and makeup, get out." I don't know why it is, and it's whether we're there or not. We might not be in front of the camera. And one time, I remember that there was a fireman putting out a fire from one of the explosions on Saving Private Ryan. So there he is, in a fireman's uniform, not look with a hose. And Stephen's saying, "Hair, makeup, get out." So when the fireman, I mean, I have to laugh. So when the fireman came out, I gave him a puff and said, "I think you're joining my department."
I love it. I absolutely love it. What was the last film you worked with him on?
What was the last film? I think it would be Ready Player One. I
Yeah.
was going to do The Fablemans, and it was a very difficult time. So I wasn't able to do that, which was a great disappointment, actually. And because it was, Stephen's story, and I would love to have
Course.
been able to work with him on that, but it wasn't the right time. It was still COVID-y and all those things, so
I
it
know.
wasn't possible.
COVID has altered things, yes. But there will be another project,
Oh, I
Lois.
hope
Farewell,
so.
I am sure. I am sure. From Steven Spielberg to Cameron Crowe, Lois Burwell continues with her stories of on-set adventures in film next week when we speak about her Academy Award-winning work in Mel Gibson's Braveheart. The passion in the stories that we cover on Center Stage can sometimes be life-changing. So I encourage you to join me with Lois next Tuesday at 9 a.m. for the continuation of our journey together. Please go to centerstagewithpamelacoon.com for more interviews like these, because this is where the magic is made. Stay safe, everyone. This is Pamela Coon, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.